You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on today's show, our studio guest is investigative journalist Stephen Davis, talking about his book Truth Teller. We'll also hear from Catherine Lawless on her novel Beachhead and how writing it helped her cope with severe agoraphobia. And Claire Hanscom will be chatting about her new novel Unscripted and working with Unbound Books. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Stephen.
Hi, Lee. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But we'll hear with Catherine and Claire how personal experiences inspired their writing. So, journalism. What made you become a journalist?
I always wanted to be a journalist. I actually have a school report written when I was 10 years old, and it says, Stephen wants to be a journalist, but will need to improve his English. So I achieved the journalism. I'm still working on the other one. For some reason, it was what I wanted to be, and I'm so lucky when I started doing it, it turned out to be what I was meant to be. And it's driven me all my life. It's more a calling for me than anything else, and I still think it's important, and I still love it, and I'm now teaching students, hopefully, to give them the same passion for it as I do.
And why investigative journalism is a very specific form?
I'm with George Orwell on this, who famously said, of course, that stories were really something that people didn't want to be disclosed, and everything else was public relations. That's not the exact quote. But being an investigative reporter is finding out things which people have done that affect people's lives, that have destroyed people's lives, but done in secret. And I think it's a public duty to bring these to people's attention. That's what real journalism is about.
You need different qualities, do you think, to be an investigative journalist?
Yes, I tell my students the main quality for being an investigative reporter is sheer bloody-minded determination. and that's it, really. And I also tell them to be prepared for a life of victories, but also crushing defeats, because you can spend a long time investigating something. And then at the end of it, after you put blood, sweat and tears into it for weeks on end, you don't get the story, or the story turns out to be different than the one you started with. So it requires a certain dogged determination.
And you were part of the famous Sunday Times Insight team, the investigative journalism team. That must have been a great experience.
It was fabulous. The Sunday Times was a wealthy paper. They had a lot of resources. They could send us anywhere and commit resources to get the story. And ironically enough, we live in a modern world now of branding, and where journalists are supposed to be personalities and get their name out there. And of course, I'm having to do a bit of that selling this book. But one of the things I loved about Insight was it was all about the story. We were anonymous. We never had a byline. It was just Insight. The name Stephen Davis never appeared on a lot of the major stories that I did. Indeed, one of the major investigations I did, which I'm proud of, first serious environmental investigation, I think, done by any newspaper in the world, where I went to the Amazon rainforest. The only record of my involvement at all is that I took a photograph, and there's a small picture caption appeared in the paper. But I love the anonymity, and I think that's how it should be. It should be about the story and the people in the story, not about the journalist.
Well, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we'll hear your first choice of music now, which is Nature by The Formula. Why have you chosen this one?
I'm a Kiwi, and this is every Kiwi's summer song from your childhood. And ironically, it's been so successful that each decade, a whole new generation of Kiwis get introduced to it.
Falling leaves, I pick my way slowly. That's Nature by The Formula, the first choice of music today on Bookmark from our studio guest, Stephen Davis. Stephen has worked for the Sunday Times in both London and Los Angeles. He's been a war and foreign correspondent, a TV producer for 60 Minutes in 2020, a newspaper editor, and a documentary filmmaker for the BBC and Discovery. He's won multiple awards for his investigative journalism, including a silver medal at the New York Film and Television Awards. Truth Teller, published earlier this year, is subtitled An Investigative Reporter's Journey Through the World of Truth Prevention, Fake News and Conspiracy Theories. Well, Stephen, I suppose the obvious question is why did you write this book?
I gave up a perfectly good job to spend 2 years writing and researching this book because I became concerned at the huge volume of misinformation and disinformation flooding around the world at a great speed with Twitter and other things. I would test my journalism students every year and give them an exercise in which they were required to research online and distinguish between fact and fiction. And each year, a lot of them would fail it. So I decided in my own small way to do something about this. I think the volumes of misinformation and disinformation around the world at the moment is like a public health emergency, although it's more likely to kill society than something like the Ebola virus. And, of course, beneath these huge volumes of misinformation and disinformation, it makes it easier for governments and corporations and dictators and other unscrupulous people to lie to you and get away with it. So the book is like a warning, as it were.
And you decided to write it in book form. You could have blogged about this. You could have vlogged about this. There's still something for you in the power of the written word on paper.
Oh, yes, I'm still a book addict, as my daughters. And it has a permanence. And I envisage it hopefully being in libraries. I envisage hopefully journalism students taking it out of their university library to read. And also because I think that the structure of the book is one that you can go back to and look at and think about the tool of deception that I happen to be describing. So, yeah, it had to be a book.
Yes, tell me about the structure. Why did you decide to structure it the way you did? Well, describe it for us first and then explain the rationale.
In Truth Teller, I list a set of tools of deception that are commonly used all over the world by various people. Shoot the messenger. The creation of conspiracy theories to hide actual conspiracy theories, the importance of distance in disguising stories. And then under each tool, I have a detailed investigation, usually mine, but also the work of some other fine journalists, where I describe how the tool works in practice and its effect on real people's lives. You know, it's very important as a journalist not to see your work as just a story. And I really emphasize this to my students. It's never just a story. It's about real people and real lives and real suffering. So the structure also, I think, lent itself to, because I've done a lot of teaching in higher education, I wanted a structure which lent itself to lessons as well for the students.
So these tools that you describe, how consciously are they used? I mean, you've labelled them, but are you suggesting that when people want to do something to obfuscate the truth, they consciously go to this toolbox, or is this just a kind of summary of what you've observed?
Oh, no, they're very conscious decisions. And there are tools, by the way, which are used and shared by people for all sorts of different reasons. One common one is it's called the big lie. And it's based on the fact that our brains are wired to treat information we hear commonly as trustworthy. That's logical if you think about it. Information you hear from your inner circle, people you like, you tend to trust. So Putin will use the big lie and Trump will use the big lie. And you say something which initially seems really outlandish and unbelievable.
Can you give us an example?
And I will give a perfect Trump example. He made his bones in the Republican Party by floating the Obama birther conspiracy, that Obama wasn't a real American and his birth certificate was faked. So you float this lie, and initially a lot of people might not believe you. And indeed, when Trump started talking about this. Most of the mainstream Republican Party didn't believe him, and most Republican voters didn't believe him. You can look at the polls. It was probably less than 5%. But you repeat it again and again and again and again, and then you get other people to repeat it, and your echo chamber, such as Fox News in Trump's case, and you can track the figures. 2 years later, most of the Republican Party believe this theory. Most Republican voters believe this theory, and the man gets elected president of the United States. And it's exactly the same technique that Putin uses to lie to his people.
And with the age of the internet, of course, these lies spread like wildfire very quickly.
Yes. People often ask me, hasn't there always been fake news? And of course there is. If you read newspapers from colonial America or Victorian England, they were very often propaganda sheets. But the difference is now is the volume and the speed at which it travels. You know, somebody says something outrageous and untrue on Twitter, and millions of people have seen it fairly instantly. Now, an hour or so later, your New York Times or your BBC might have published something explaining why it's wrong or completely untrue or half true, but it's too late. It's rocketed around the world. The other problem is that people actually like spreading this stuff. There's a very good study done, I think, at MIT, which shows that falsehoods travel more quickly than the truth, that people don't even read to the end of the tweet, 140 characters before they retweet it, can't even get to the end of that, and that people secretly like spreading this stuff because social media acceptance, and it gives them a sort of feeling of power. You know, they know something that somebody else doesn't.
Well, I mean, I love a good conspiracy theory, but what was interesting in your book was how conspiracy theories are used to hide real conspiracies. And that had never occurred to me.
Yeah, let me just talk about conspiracy theories for a minute, because I'm afraid I'm going to tell you off. Conspiracy theories are loved by people, but they are incredibly dangerous. You and I might pass on something that we think is just mildly amusing or a joke or whatever, and there'll be some young man sitting in his mother's basement with access to guns who believes it, and we can see terrible consequences of that. But of course, now you have a very sophisticated way of generating conspiracy theories, as I say in Truth Teller, to hide actual conspiracy theories. A good example is when the former Russian intelligence officer Skripal was poisoned in England. Now, it's pretty clear the Russians did it. They were the only people with a motive, and I think two of their agents were actually caught on CCTV camera. But if you trace that story, within 10 days, there were four other conspiracy theories about it generated and circulating rapidly around the world. So now if I say to you, let's go back and look at that story and tell me what happened, you might come to me and say, well, hold on, Stephen. And my students might come to me and say, well, hold on, Stephen, there are five different theories. How can I possibly tell what's true? And that's an incredibly effective way of disguising things.
So who's this book for? This book is for everybody then who engages at some level with news and politics.
Yeah, I hope it's read by a lot of journalism students. I hope it's read by a lot of adults who are kind of desperate for information about this stuff. I was invited to give a speech in a small New Zealand town in the South Island to a group of retirees who were apparently interested in keeping themselves educated and informed. And I turn up in the hall and there were 200 people there. And they are saying to me, well, we want to know about this stuff. We don't want to be misled. How do we work this stuff out? How do we know when we're being lied to? Who can we trust? This is a huge issue worldwide now.
How does this affect your engagement with the world, with politics, with news, when you pick up a newspaper? Are you always thinking, well, that's not true, that's not true? Are you reading between the lines or trying to guess what's really been said?
Well, I'm following some basic rules, which is sometimes if a story seems too good to be true, it is. I don't believe any story that's not multi-sourced. If something interesting pops up, then I'll go and check it and see if it appears anywhere else. But one of the real problems with this strategy, you know, is if the powers that be, the dictators of this world and the Donald Trumps of this world and corporations trying to deceive us, if they eventually turn us off the whole subject of news and make it so nobody believes anything, they won as well, of course, because then they can lie to their heart's content. So, you know, it is a serious issue. And, you know, to get back to conspiracy theories, I, in researching the book, and I've been lucky enough to be given a contract for a new book, which is due in October, and I've written zero words, so I'm feeling pretty anxious about it. I looked at the conspiracy theories involving 9/11, and there are 22 of them now. 22 different mutually contradictory conspiracy theories. And number 22 is written by a woman whose book no doubt will sell more than I, at least on Amazon. And it says that there was a space weapon in outer space which zapped a beam down and hit the Twin Towers. She admits it happened at the same time the planes flew into the towers. So I'm not quite sure why. But you look at this woman's work, and you look at the way it's spread around the internet, and you look at the number of people who believe it. And by the way, as an author, you know, when you write your introduction to your book, you kind of boast a little about your experience. But I have nothing on this book, because the introduction to her book says something like, you are now holding in your hands the most important book of the 21st century.
That's quite a claim.
But I mention this and you laugh and I laugh. And every time I mention it to students, they laugh. But as I said, the danger is that you might get 10,000 people not believing it, but behind that, there's 100,000 people believing it. And we would be shocked and amazed at how conspiracy theories catch on and are believed by people all over the world. I mean, I'm sitting in a car with a very nice Moroccan man driving from Granada to Seville only 2 weeks ago, and he suddenly starts talking about wind turbines and how they cause cancer, because outside of Seville there are wind turbines. And that's kind of scary enough. But then he says, when I was a kid, I read this amazing book at school about the Jews. And I said, what did you read? And he said, I read The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And it's fantastic stuff. And I kind of paused, gritted my teeth. And then I tried to explain to him that, you know, it was concocted by the Tsarist secret police in 1905 and it's completely fake. But he didn't believe it. And lots of people all over the world. And if you follow the rise of white supremacists, the shooter who in my own country recently killed a lot of people in a mosque, this stuff is still widely believed. So I'm afraid conspiracy theories, while sometimes entertaining, are actually dangerous, and I'm very disapproving.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I feel disapproved of. I promise I'll back away from conspiracy theories in future. Thank you, Stephen. We'll take a slight sidestep now, and we'll hear from Catherine Lawless. Her first novel, Beach Hut, was published earlier this year. As a result of childhood trauma, Catherine suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder. One of the symptoms is agoraphobia. So because she was unable to come into the studio to chat, I interviewed Catherine on the phone and started by asking her in what ways the agoraphobia affects her life.
It affects me in as much as I have the most acute panic attacks, whereby I can't actually leave the house. If I do leave the house, there's a chance I'll just completely lose control of my legs. I can't walk. I can't breathe. It actually feels like I'm being buried alive. You kind of get to a point where you just think, you know what, actually, I'm not even going to risk going out today, which unfortunately then obviously manifests itself into agoraphobia, because before you know it, it's, you know, you feel safe at home. So it's just like, right, well, I'm, you know I'm safe here. And the last thing I want to do is to have a panic attack. I'd embarrass myself or put myself in a vulnerable position. So therefore, it kind of feeds into the agoraphobia. The agoraphobia sort of grows from that sort of initial panicky feeling. I talk a lot to the military, and you know, I know there's a lot of very highly decorated men and women that can't leave the house due to agoraphobia, due to PTSD. I think the worst bit about it is there's a lot of the sort of stigma of, you know, you just need to pull yourself together and you have to get on with it, you know. And unfortunately, it's very simple to say that, but when a person does suffer with it, it's almost impossible, if I'm honest.
And when I called you, you were in the garden, so you can go outside within the limits of your house, but anything other than that presents a problem.
Sometimes it's not too... And my husband built me a log cabin in the garden so that I could leave the house, and it sounds silly, but at least I could then get out. There are days I can get to therapy. There are days I can get to go swimming or to go and do yoga on a good day. And that's what I have to sort of force myself to at least try, because not just that, the more days that I get out and I've done something, obviously then I can celebrate, and it sort of makes the agoraphobia diminish a little bit. I made it, so therefore I'm not as bad as I was. I've just learned now, and I'm very fortunate with my friend and my husband, you know, they're very supportive. They know if I say today's not a good day, they've learned. She probably knows better than most of us. And whereas before, I'd be sort of forced to, like, oh, please just come for an hour, or please. And then obviously I get poorly. I think now they realise that I'm sort of probably the best person to gauge what I can and can't do.
Did it present any problems when it came to writing the book?
Your world becomes very small with regards to agoraphobia. But what I did with, certainly with Beach Hut, is I made my character, I suppose, have the life that I couldn't. In some ways, if I'm honest, perhaps it helped. It sort of helped inspire the character. And the second book in the series that I'm writing at the moment, again, it's she's doing everything I wished I'd done, everything, you know, that I couldn't do. That in a way, that's escapism for me. It's the wonderful thing with an imagination. You can sort of travel anywhere, really, I guess.
So tell me about Beach Hut. What's it about?
It's about a singer-songwriter who has fled an abusive relationship with her daughter. They've moved to a beautiful little village near her parents. There that they start to rebuild their lives. It's a very light, bright book in places, quite humorous. It is a romantic novel, but at the same time, the important thing for me was to cover real issues like PTSD, anxiety, domestic violence, and agoraphobia, because I suppose for me, if somebody's reading it and they think they've picked up a lovely summer read or something, and they can acknowledge, gosh, you know, I'm like that, I have these symptoms. You know, a lot of people sort of remain quiet and silent because they don't want people thinking that they're crazy, or they don't, you know, they want to be judged, or, and they perhaps suffer unnecessarily when it's, I like to say, just anxiety, because I always hold on to it's just anxiety, powerful as it is and as disabling as it is. But it gives me hope that it, you know, I can get beyond it, and I can, and hopefully one day that I can actually get out and live a reasonably normal life. And I'm hoping that with the book that I don't know, maybe it will just sort of say to somebody, oh, actually, that's the sort of symptoms I get. Does that mean I've got sort of anxiety, or does that mean I'm struggling a little bit with agoraphobia? Because I've met women as well, a lot of women with the menopause with very similar symptoms that they thought was the menopause, but actually it's sort of, that sort of triggered a little bit of agoraphobia too, a lot of anxiety. And once they sort of recognised it, they were able to treat the symptoms and make their life hopefully a bit easier.
But I imagine it's quite hard when you want to write a story and you want to include issues, because you don't want to just shoehorn the issues in, do you, so that you're lecturing people. So how did you decide to incorporate it within the story?
She flees her ex-partner, and well, he's quite abusive, he's very controlling. It's very sort of gently placed in the book before she realises that actually perhaps distancing herself from him, she's able to look a bit closer and realise actually that was quite controlling behaviour, that was bullying, that was... and then as she's rebuilding her confidence, she's suffering with panic attacks. At the same time, she's dealing with them, she's learning ways in which to control them, tools to help deal with it. It's a tiny part of the story, but at the same time, to me, it's very important that it's in there, because it's still very sort of much true to life, and very similar to sort of what I've experienced. And I wanted, as I say, that escapism for me, whereby she gets over it, she gets better. You know, for me, I can hold on to that as well.
And you say you're writing a second one, or the second one coming out. Are these the same characters as in Beach Hut?
Yep, same characters. Obviously, some new ones as well. That will also cover the same issues. Well, the characters are still in there. And there's obviously lots of characters that don't have anxiety or PTSD as well. So it's continuing on with it, really, and watching them grow. Years ago, I got absolutely hooked on the Jilly Cooper books, and I just love the escapism, but I love to pick it up and sort of revisit the same sort of characters and to see what had happened. And so I suppose for me it's been wonderful. I wasn't ready to let them go at the end of Beach Hut. In fact, two sort of came in at the end that I thought, no, these really do need to continue living on, and they need their story as well. That's the wonderful beauty of writing, I suppose. I remember once actually going to the RNA and there were a couple of ladies there, and one of the ladies said to one of the other authors, I thought you said that your main character was going to be killed off in this latest novel. And he didn't. You lied. She said, I didn't lie. She said, he just refused to die. And it's really funny because, you know, when you start out writing a book, I mean, I know we're all different, we do it differently, but we're not quite sure. Well, certainly for me, I have no idea where it's going and what's happening. It's the most incredible experience because all the characters come alive in your head to the point, especially because I've based it where I live. It's almost like I expect to see the characters. And funny enough, I've lent the book to a couple of friends, and they too have said they got so into the characters that they were sort of half expected to see them on the common. And I think that's really special to be able to have that. And this for me, they've sort of kept me sane, kept me happy, you know, and I just love to see what they're going to do next.
And related to that, part of that, you've become a campaign champion at Women's Aid.
Yes, I'm very proud of that, actually. And actually, my book launch that we're having, they're sponsoring it. So we're hopefully going to sort of incorporate a little fundraiser with it too. You know, the work they do is fantastic. I think anything I can do to help feels wonderful. And I think I've had such incredible support myself. It feels nice to give something back.
And Beecher by Catherine Lawless is published by Sarah Grace Publishing. Listening to that with me on Bookmark was our studio guest today, Stephen Davies, here to talk about his book, Truth Teller. Stephen, Catherine there talking about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, just made me wonder what effect being an investigative journalist had on you, because you were threatened. You've been threatened many times.
Yes, I've been lucky, though, because however many times I was threatened, and by men with guns or by a senior police officer who absurdly said, I know where you live, like in a bad movie, or by Jeff Hoon, the then Labour Defence Minister, telling an MP that he should be wary of me because I was a bit of a fantasist, which struck me as laughable coming from a man whose government produced the totally fantastical weapons of mass destruction dossier that led us into war with Iraq. But I'm lucky. You know, you look at brave colleagues, a colleague I worked with in Russia who was killed, journalists who work in Turkey, journalists who work in these other countries, they have a whole different degree of trouble. And of course, you know, we live in a world now where journalists are locked up and killed, where Saudi Arabia sends a hit team to Turkey to dismember a columnist they didn't like. It's pretty scary stuff. The other thing I wanted to pick up on was about PTSD. I have dealt in my reporting with a lot of soldiers. Many of them are special forces, so elite troops from, you know, the Special Air Service and SBS and Delta in the United States. I mean, you know, tough, competent men. When they come back from their missions, they're just basically expected to get on with it. And many of them actually end up suffering severe trauma, maybe not to the extent that they can't leave the house, but, you know, real issues because they see things and have to do things which you and I can't even conceive of.
How do you let these subjects go? Because obviously you get very involved with them, and that as an investigative journalist, I guess you have to move on to the next thing.
Well, no, I don't let them go, unfortunately. Perhaps I should. I'm extremely stubborn, and I don't let go of a story until I think it's reached its conclusion. So an example, I have been investigating the horrific circumstances in which the human shields of the first Gulf War were treated after Saddam's invasion of Kuwait in August 1990, and I'm still investigating it, and indeed have a project on that next year. So maybe that means I'm slow, or maybe it means I'm determined. So I've been working on that story for 30 years. One of the ways, by the way, in the book Truth Teller, in which people deflect investigations now, I call the chapter Delay, Delay, Delay Until Everyone Gets Bored. So our news cycle is rapid now, and journalists are treated to, you know, they're taught to cover social media, and everything is so fast. And if something's more than 24 hours old, it's completely old. This is very effective for people who want to keep secrets, because somebody will do a story and then some other reporter will ring up, and even though the story hasn't reached its conclusion, they'll say, oh yeah, this is an old story, or, you know, it was last week, last month, last year. And in that way, they deflect. And sometimes, except for a few stubborn individuals like myself, they get away with it.
Well, we'll come back to that, Stephen. This is an appropriate song title. Can't Take My Eyes Off You. Andy Williams talk about Tenacious. Why have you chosen this as your second track?
Oh, well, that was my courting song for my wife, Penny, and everybody has one, and this is mine. And I've always loved the song. I think Andy Williams is terrific.
You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you. You'd be like heaven to touch. I wanna hold you so much. At long last, love has arrived, and I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you. Pardon the way that I stay. There's nothing else to compare. The sight of you leaves me weak. There are no words left to speak. But if you feel like I feel, please let me know that it's real. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you.
Mark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations rather than books.
And our guest on Bookmark today is investigative journalist Stephen Davis, talking about his book Truth Teller. Stephen, are you optimistic about journalism, the future of journalism?
I tell people I started Truth Teller as an optimist, ended up as somewhat of a pessimist, because the level of fakery will only get worse with artificial intelligence coming on the line, and even simple things like distorting Nancy Pelosi's voice and, you know, posting it on Facebook, and amazingly Facebook refusing to take it down even though it's fake. But there are green shoots of optimism. I think one of the failings of journalism is actually we have not explained to people consistently the value of what we do. I use the example of when I became a cadet journalist on the New Zealand Herald, all the President's Men came out with Redford and Hoffman, and journalists were heroes and, you know, pretty good looking. And now, especially on a British drama, if you see a journalist portrayed, it's often portrayed as a tabloid sleazebag. So that's where we've got to. But there are green shoots. People are realizing you have to pay for good journalism. One of the things I hammer away to my students, they like free stuff, free music, free internet, free everything. I say, if you want free stuff, you're going to get fake news and propaganda. If you want good journalism and investigative reporting, you have to pay for it. So now, last year, 1 million people donated money to The Guardian. The New York Times has now, I think, 2.5 million at least digital subscribers. Once people realize that good journalism is valuable and you need to pay for it, I think that'll be a positive thing.
Because there's so many layers of fakery now. There's fake news, then there's fake news. It's bewildering to a reader.
Yes, and as I said, that's very good for people who want to lie to you, that the alternative to seeking out real journalism and paying for it is just to shrug your shoulders and say, it's all too much, there's all too much of it, and then I won't believe anything at all. And then, of course, as a society, if we lose the ability to tell the difference between truths and untruths, we're kind of doomed. I mean, we have no basis to make any rational decisions.
And we were talking about conspiracies earlier. Is there one conspiracy that's still in existence that you mentioned the human shields there in the Iraq War. Is that the one that really gets your goat, as it were?
There's a couple in Truth Teller. One, the sinking of the ferry Estonia. But the second one, yes, the human shields, which really still makes me angry. A British Airways flight lands in Kuwait. The people are captured by Saddam Hussein and used as human shields. A couple of interesting things about this. It's an example of the fact that the first version of a story is often the one that's most believed. And spin doctors know this, so they try and get their version out first. So when reporters were asking questions about why the plane landed and what these people were doing, they were told, oh, don't worry, nothing to see here. It's not a story. These people are sipping cocktails by the pool at luxury hotels. It's like an extended holiday. Interestingly enough, that was true for about 3 days. The Iraqis didn't know what to do with them, so they put them at the Hilton and the Marriott and things, and no doubt some of them were sipping cocktails by the pool in the sunshine. After 3 days, they were taken off to parts of Iraq and Kuwait that Saddam thought the Allies would bomb, and they lived in the most appalling conditions. And here's the... So first off, why the plane landed was covered up, but what's in a sense even worse, the Royal Military Police were commissioned after the war to go and interview all the British human shields. They interviewed 1,800 people, and they produced a report. It's absolutely shocking. We are talking over 70 sexual assaults of men and women. We are talking about mock executions. We're talking about near starvation conditions. Appalling things. What did the British government do with that report, which is called Operation Sandcastle? They classified it as a secret. And it's still a secret to this day, 29 years later. Because, of course, if they release the report and people realize what a horrible hostage-taking this was and how these people suffered, more people might start asking, well, how did they end up there in the first place?
It's also about the power of an image, isn't it? I mean, instantly, when you talk about that story, an image comes to mind of, was it Saddam and a little boy?
Yes. So Saddam had some hostages, and it was a made-for-Iraqi TV stunt. And there's a terrible picture of him patting a little boy on the head called Stuart Lockwood, which went around the world. What's less well known is that he went up to another little boy who, when he leant over, the little boy kicked him hard on the shins. And his parents, of course, were, oh, what have you done? You know, have you got us into trouble? And he gave them a murderous look, but then he kind of laughed and moved on. But you're right, images are iconic. Images can be deceiving, though. One of the other famous images of the war is the shattered tail of the British Airways 149 flight on the runway. Now, the story told was that the Iraqis had blown it up as they fled Kuwait when they were kicked out by Bush and Thatcher's Grand Coalition. I always thought this was very odd because the Iraqis literally looted everything lootable from Kuwait, including the taps and sinks and so forth. And they had this British Airways plane. Why did they not just fly it back to Baghdad? What a prize. And I know, and as I say in Truth Teller, it wasn't blown up by the Iraqis at all. It was blown up by American fighter aircraft. And a consequence of it blowing up was that British Airways got a huge insurance payout, which is ironic because none of the British passengers who were used as human shields got a single penny.
Thank you, Stephen. It is a fascinating book. Let's take another sidestep now and hear from Claire Hanscom. Claire was recently longlisted for the Bath Novel Award, and her journalism, poetry and essays have appeared in a wide variety of publications, including Writing Magazine and The Washington Post. I met Claire when she came to Cambridge for an authory event at WH Smith's, and I started by asking her to tell me what her novel, Unscripted, was about.
It's about a young woman with a crush on an actor and a determined plan to get him to marry her.
Romantic comedy?
Romantic, yes. Comedy, I didn't set out to write a comedy. There are some funny parts, but it's a little bit more earnest than a comedy, I think.
And it's set in Cambridge?
Partly in Cambridge. So the young woman in question is a Cambridge graduate, and she has a lot of friends from her Cambridge days that she still meets up with a lot in London where she lives, but there's a lot of flashbacks to their time in Cambridge together.
Why set in Cambridge?
Well, partly because I went to Cambridge and have very happy memories of that time, but also because it was really important to me that she be well-educated and intelligent, because I think sometimes there's a perception that if you're passionate about something or you're a bit of a fangirl about something, that maybe you're a bit two-dimensional or a bit slow or a bit weird in some way. And it was important to me that she had an education and had more to her than just this two-dimensional thing, so people can see that just being passionate about something doesn't make it invalid, doesn't make you stupid.
Cambridge is a picturesque place as well. Did that help?
Yeah, I mean, I like to think it would make it more likely to become a film one day, and definitely there's a lot to describe, you know, the Punting and the colleges and the King's Chapel and all that kind of thing. There's plenty to fill the pages in terms of description.
You mentioned film there. Did you have people in your head when you were writing this?
To play the characters later on. Yes and no. And the actors that I had in my head are too old now to really be in the... Sorry, they probably won't thank me for saying that. But they'll also never listen to this, so it's fine. You never know. But they're US-based, so I doubt they'll be listening to Radio Cambridge. But you never know. I think Rose Byrne, who was in Juliet Naked, which is an adaptation of a Nick Hornby novel, would be a great Ebba, who's one of the old, slightly older characters. I got that idea partly because she was in a film where there's some of the themes are quite similar in terms of there's a American star and things like that. But aside from that, anyone will do. I've been told that the actor on the front looks a bit like Ryan Gosling from the back, so that would work too.
Are you a fan of romantic comedies?
Yes, I love them. I really miss the kind of 90s era romantic comedies. I've watched Notting Hill, which also has similar themes to my book, more times than I can count. I rewatch Love Actually every Christmas. I rewatch Bridget Jones's Diary once in a while. And yeah, I really wish more of those films would get made. I think they're really wonderful.
And you say love actually has got themes similar to the ones in your book. What are the themes in your book?
Fame and friendship and second chances. And I mean, the big thing that it shares in common with Notting Hill is this idea of a mere mortal falling in love with a, or falling in love in inverted commas, with a superstar, and whether that can ever become anything real. And that's the major theme of my book too.
And it's published with Unbound. Tell us a bit about Unbound.
Unbound are an innovative publisher. They've been around a few years and they operate by crowdfunding, which means that before a book is offered a publishing deal, you have to basically fund it yourself through your friends and family and strangers who might want to pre-order a book. It's a bit like Kickstarter for people who know things like that, where you pledge in response for rewards. So the main reward is you get your name in the back of the book thanking you for helping bring the book about, which is pretty cool. You also can have mugs and t-shirts and stickers and, you know, all that paraphernalia. Could be anything from having a song written for you to a picture drawn for you. I didn't have that kind of talent, so I didn't get to offer any of that. But it's a little bit like Kickstarter, but for writers.
And different self-publishing?
Yes, because once your book is funded, it is treated like a normal book published by a normal publisher. So you go through rounds of edits. You don't always have the final say on everything. With self-publishing, you get to control absolutely everything, but you then don't have a name behind you backing you and giving you the kind of prestige and credibility that you get with a publisher. So yes, it's different from self-publishing, for better or for worse, and it's also different from mainstream publishing. It's somewhere in between.
And after you've raised all that money, it must be great for you now to see the book.
Yes, and my friends who helped me raise the money, who were good enough to buy a copy before it even existed as a physical object, it's great that they've read it and they like it. And so yes, everyone's proud of me, which is a lovely feeling.
And what's it like for you to be back in Cambridge? When was the last time you were here?
I come back fairly regularly whenever I come back to the UK. I live in the US now. It's really lovely. I love coming back. I was at King's, so I love sitting by the river and, you know, watching the punts go by and going into Chapel if I can. I mean, I have such happy memories of my time here. A lot of my Cambridge friends actually came to my book launch in London last week, and it was really lovely to see them. Also, with speaking in WH Smith's, and I actually worked in this WH Smith's for a few weeks after I graduated, so that's surreal, because that was 18 years ago or something ridiculous. So yeah, surreal and nice, which is actually a line from Notting Hill, so yes.
And what next for you then?
There's a sequel of sorts to this book which hasn't been published yet, which is the actor in the book has four kids and the eldest of them is 12 in Unscripted. And so 2 years later, she's adapting to a life that has had some changes in it. Can't say what changes, because otherwise it gives away the end of this book. It's her story 2 years later. So it's a sequel of sorts, not exactly a sequel in the traditional sense, but it's the same characters come back. And then I guess I'll write something else as well next, but I don't know what yet.
Will you go back with the Unbound experience?
Probably not. It was very hard work, and it's also, your friends are happy to support you. They know it's a dream come true to have a novel out in the world, but I think I'd feel a bit cheeky asking them to do that again. And although you can get strangers help fund you, and strangers did help fund me, it's very slow. If you were to rely on just strangers doing it, it could take years to fund a book. So I don't think I have that kind of patience.
And Unscripted by Claire Hanscom is published, as we heard, by Unbound Books. A studio guest today on Bookmark is Stephen Davis, here to tell about his book, Truth Teller, which is published by Exile Publishing. Stephen, you touched there, and Claire was talking about films, and you touched before on films and All the President's Men, and how journalists are portrayed. Is there a good film about journalists that you think is honest and fair?
Yes, I mean, about investigative reporting, about its difficulties, about its meticulous nature. There's the film recently done about the investigation by the Boston newspaper into the sexual crimes committed by the Catholic Church in Boston. And actually, right at the second, the name of it is completely
Yes, and I saw it as well, and I can't remember it either.
But one of the things that that movie captures is the sheer grind and hard work, and the fact that a lot of people won't help you. My journalism students, some of them expect, they'll go out, they'll tell people they're a journalist, and they'll say, yes, I confess, you know, or yes, I'll give you all the information you need. And I explain, you know, 90, 95% of people won't help you. And it's hard work, and you have to persist, and you have to develop a relationship of trust, because a source generally, imagine a source within the Catholic Church or a source within Special Forces or the Intelligence Services or any of the people I've dealt with, when they tell you things, they are actually breaking a trust with their own employer. They're potentially putting themselves at risk. So it's really hard work, so that they know you can trust them and they can trust you. That's what it's really all about.
Spotlight, is that
Spotlight.
It?
Spotlight, well done. I was struggling to get there.
Yeah, got there. What about you? How do you relax? We've been talking about very serious and earnest things. How do you switch off from that? Do you switch off from that?
Yeah, I do. I read lots of books. I watch lots of movies of all descriptions. I like romantic comedies, ironically enough, that she was referring to. One of my issues actually with modern mainstream media coverage is the tendency to blur the lines between entertainment and news. You know, I want to watch the BBC News to see news. And then if I want entertainment news, I want to see it separately and not have the two mixed up together. But that's just probably me being old, boring and traditional. Yeah, I watch a lot of movies. And of course, being a Kiwi, I am a huge rugby fan because, you know, world champion All Blacks and all that. Best side in the world.
So just sneak that one in.
Yeah.
And what next for you? You were talking about this book you're doing about the human shields.
Yes, well, look, I've got, ironically enough, discussion on two potential TV projects. The Human Shields investigation, I'm talking to a company that recently produced a very well-received drama about Brexit starring Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, yes, the Uncivil War.
And I am talking to some Norwegians about the sinking of the ferry Estonia, which is the worst shipping disaster in Europe since the Titanic, and a subject of one of my other investigations. So, but my experience, to be honest, with TV production, you don't hold your breath. If something happens, that'll be great, but I'm not relying on it. I have, however, got a contract for a second book, and that is exclusively devoted to what I think is the damage done by out-of-control social media and viral journalism on society. And as I said, I've written zero words in a deadline of mid-October.
It'll happen. It'll happen. And the question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Yeah, I'm fascinated by spies, obviously, and not least the dual nature of their personality. And because when I interview them, I have to work hard to work out whether I'm being told the truth or a lie. So I like spy thrillers, and I particularly like an author called Mick Herron, who has written a lot of fabulous books. And the most recent one is This Is What Happened, which I'm halfway through and enjoying thoroughly, because he captures the sometimes mundane and bizarre life of the spy, and also because it has a lot of dark humour, and I really like that.
He's a regular visitor to Cambridge as
well. Yeah. I would have loved to have met him.
Well, thank you. It's been great talking to you. Thank you, Stephen. As I say, Truth Teller is published by XL Publishing. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your final choice of music. But a heads up, our next show, which is the last in this series, our studio guest is James DeLaghi. He'll be talking about his new thriller, 55. We'll also hear from Mandy Morton about the latest book in her number 2 feline detective agency, which is called Beyond the Gravy. And we'll also be chatting to 9-year-old Farah Lucas from Haslingfield, who's a regional finalist in a writing award. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Stephen, which is Bob Dylan and Knocking on Heaven's Door. Why this one?
Bob Dylan, I think, is a genius. There's a bit of a kind of anti-Dylan backlash at the moment, absurdly, because he's very popular and very successful, but that's nonsense, I think. The man is a genius, he's a poet, and this is a great song and also one of the best movies I've ever seen, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, which it's in a scene in.
Take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, 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 knocking on heaven's door. Mama put my guns in the ground. I can't shoot them anymore. That long black cloud is coming down. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door.